Bernard. Give her a round of applause.
Thanks, James. Now, I don't know where you want me to stand. Do you want me to stand? Do you want me to walk around?
Just scare them, yeah. Especially the kids up in the back row, the naughty ones. Yes. Just walk up there and back just to make them realise that they can't play on their phones.
So, resilience is quite a big topic. And there are many myths around resilience. And thanks, James, for introducing a very old version of what resilience used to be. And the term resilience has quite a notorious understanding about it, that we used to think that it was just resistance, or that it was repression, or that it was just pushing through without really understanding what it was that you were dealing with. But today we know so much more, and we know so much more because of neuroscience. We now have machines like MRIs where we are able to put people through scanners and we can detect in their brain very, very clearly the areas of the brain that are active under particular conditions and the areas of the brain that are inactive under other conditions. And so I want to start my talk about resilience with my very first experience of it. Now, I've not told this story before, so I'm just hoping that I'm going to hold myself in anchor when I do tell it. My father was a migrant, an Italian migrant, and he left his homeland because of the post-war depression. And, you know, there are big stories around that, but I want to tell you one small story that would happen often in my house. When dinner was finished, Mum would wash the dishes, Dad had worked the whole day, and then he'd go and sit down on the couch and watch TV. And when he'd watch TV, and it was normally Sale of the Century, those early days, and when he'd watch TV, he'd have his favourite couch. And the area of the couch that he would sit on had big arms of the armchair. And he would sit with his hand out, because that's how he would rest. And I was about five when I noticed it. So he would sit on the couch and I'd just crawl around him and sometimes sit on his lap. And I remember one time, and this was the time, and I would have been about five, where he was sitting down and he had his hand out, and I was fascinated with his hands because it had grooves in it. And he saw that I was fascinated. So what he did is that as I was looking, he opened his hand out. And I call this story artichoke hands. Because when he opened up his hand, see the lines that we have on our hands? Well, his just weren't lines. They were very deep. Where the lines were, imagine very, very deep, deep grooves. That when you open your hand, it would open up like an artichoke. And when he closed his hand, it would close back up. Now, I remember being horrified. Now, this is the important part about resilience. I remember being horrified and thinking to myself, that must hurt. Because your hands open up, and they open up into this sort of a fan-like. And I put my little finger in, and he would quickly close his hand, and of course that was a bit of a game, but I was horrified. So I remember going off the chair, going to get some hand cream, coming back, because in my little brain I thought, I've got to fix this. We're going to come back to the notion of fixing. And so I put hand cream in, and I tried to rub the hand cream in, but of course the hand cream wasn't being absorbed because his hands were so calloused. My father was a dynamite specialist, and he used to work for the MMBW, the Melbourne Metropolitan Board of Works back then. And what he would do is that he would come in and he would help clear out and then put in all of the dynamite deep into the ground in order to create explosives so that it would break up the rock. But he also used to, one of his jobs was that he had to bring the mats, the big thick mats, and place them over the hole in order to stop the dynamite fallout. And of course those mats were made of asbestos. Yes, yes. So, going back to my father's hands, I remember thinking to myself, why doesn't this cream fix it? And why are his hands so hurt? And I remember him saying to me when I said to him, but doesn't it hurt? And he laughed and he said, oh no. He said, these are the hands that work so hard so that you can go to school and you can keep eating chicken drumsticks, because I used to love my mother's chicken drumsticks. And that was my first experience of resilience. Where there is harm and there is hurt, but there is an understanding that that adversity has a really big part to play in the promotion of growth. And so here we are today, in a society that avoids harm, avoids discomfort, avoids feeling unpleasant, avoids experiences where we are displaced, where we believe, and falsely so, that if we continue to chase and be obsessed with positive emotion, that if we just find that constant sweet spot that I always feel okay, that's what resilience looks like. And yet that is so far from the truth. So when we are talking about what is resilience, resilience is a very big concept. And what I grew up with was a level of optimism that I simply cannot find in modern day families. And optimism is a really interesting feature, because optimism has two sub-features that must be present. The first one is that optimism requires hope. And hope is an emotion that allows you to believe, it allows you to believe that whatever can happen next, there is opportunity for that to be better than where you are. And the second sub-feature is that optimism has a perspective of forward movement. So when we think about resilience is not backward. When we take a step back because of adversity, we're avoiding. And if we remain back, that's depression. If we jump forward without thinking, and we jump forward because of fear, that's anxiety. Because I'm not thinking about what's coming. All I'm worried about is the worst outcome that's forward. But resilience is very, very different. Resilience is hard work. So as a clinician, and Linda will tell you, if we had our doors opened at the clinic for 24 hours, we would have people rotating in and rotating out on the hour. And yet it makes no difference to people's recovery. And it's not because we don't provide the skills, or it's not because we don't provide the tools, or it's not because we don't have intervention plans to allow people to be better. It's not that. It is that people are not investing in their well-being and what they need to do in order to be better. And so we call this the say-do gap. The say-do gap. What I say that I need to do and what I actually do can be very, very different. And then what we also found out over the years of our clinic is that people's belief of what better looks like or it can be is very, very different to what it needs to be, because resilience requires effort. For us to develop our resilience, we need to work very, very hard at developing a set of skills or strategies or tools that enable us to be able to perform when we need to perform, to identify our risks when there are risks, and to have a higher quality thinking. And optimism plays a really big part in that. Now, when we have a look at what our current stats are telling us, we have the highest level of mental illness ratio in Australia than we've ever had. And we've got to ask why. Why is it that Australia, First Nation country, First World country, why is it that our rates of mental illness are soaring? 2 in 5. 2 in 5. Here is a table of 5. 2 people. That's our reality. I was about to say, if you have a look at each other, if everyone turns and looks at each other, do me a favour. Can you choose 3 other people, have a look at them, turn around, have a good look. This is a silent activity. Just turn around. Turn around. Yeah? Just have a good look. Now, here's the rule. If those people look good to you, you should be worried. So let's have a look. You go, what is it? What is it about our lack of resilience? Now, I could be on this topic for hours because there is so much to explore. But let's just take a couple of features here. And the first one is that where there is a negativity bias, where I operate in a mindset or a belief system from a deficit perspective, where I get up in the morning and I focus on all the things that are wrong, I focus on all the things that I want to complain about. I'll get up in the morning and my kids' shoes are everywhere, no one's clean, no one's closed the dishwasher from the night before. Yeah, so I can get up and I go, oh, and I'm upset about that, oh, and I'm upset about, oh, and I'm upset about, oh, and that doesn't work. And why hasn't that been put away? And how hard is it to fold your towels properly and put them in the linen cupboard with the fold facing out, not facing the other way? Toilet paper. How hard is it to replace a roll with a paper over and not under? Right.
It's not that bloody hard.
So here's what the research says. We call that a pessimistic mindset. Now here's what the research also says. People who operate daily as a pattern, not when it needs to, but as a pattern, who operate with a negativity mindset are 6 times more likely to experience depression. 6 times. Not 1, not 2, not 3, 6 times more likely. Why? Because neuroscience tells us that our internal dialogue, what I say to myself that is invisible to everybody else, my internal dialogue, research says our internal dialogue directs neural functioning. So when I say to myself, I can't, I won't. Now, I know that that's not rocket science. But because we can't see a broken mind, if you have a broken leg, we can see it and we can empathise with it. But it's more than that. It is about if you can't see a broken mind, you place less value to how broken it is. And when we don't understand the break, if there is a broken leg, we understand the break. We understand that that bone needs to be replaced, realigned, it needs to be scaffolded, it needs to be held in place, it needs particular care in a particular way. And then the best thing about a broken leg is that people come to you and they say, can I sign that cast? Can I put my name on there? Can I draw a love heart? Can I say Maria was here with a glass of wine? But when your mind is broken, people don't come. When your mind is broken, that there are ways that we behave that people are confused about or that we misunderstand, and there is a disconnection from others. And so when we are talking about resilience, resilience is a concept where we build a range of skills that enable us that grow our well-being prior to any adversity. Prior to any adversity. Now let's talk about the Port Arthur incident. Because Australia had a huge amount of learning that occurred during that time. I was on the State Emergency Management Team. We had a call that came out. In those days I had a pager. Thanks, Wendy. I had a pager. Pager went off and we've gone, what's going on? And suddenly there was a call for emergency personnel. And we got it wrong. Because this was our learning. We got it wrong. And what we got wrong was this. That at the time we believed that where there is adversity, that you need to immediately go in and you need to help fix it for somebody else. But what we learnt was this. It wasn't the incident that became our learning point, but it was the post-incident. What happens after? So what we found was this, and this is the beautiful research that we have. If whether you are what we call resilient positive or whether you're resilient negative, prior to any adversity, if you are resilient positive and you've been trained in well-being, you've been trained in mental fitness, you actually know what it is that makes you well, that promotes good coping, that promotes good adaptive skills. In comparison to if you are resilient negative, if you are resilient negative, you are impoverished, you tend to, in those human assets, you tend to be reactive, you tend to be, you tend to have low tolerance, you have low pain sensitivity, we know that. But here's what the research says. Whether you are resilient negative or whether you are resilient positive does not stop you from experiencing the pain when adversity hits. You experience it exactly the same. Just because you have high level resilience doesn't mean you don't hurt when the adversity hits, and it doesn't mean you don't fall over, and it doesn't mean you are not displaced, and it does not mean that somehow you turn into Superman or Superwoman and you are protected from the fallout. That's not how it works. We have a biology, and that biology is human, and that humanness means we feel. So where there is an adversity, you are going to be in pain. Expect it. Resilience says expect the pain. But what we now know about resilience is that if prior to the adversity you were resilient negative, you then experience the adversity, between 6 and 12 months later, you are more likely to experience post-traumatic stress disorder. Not because of the adversity, but because of the lack of resourcing that you had prior to the adversity. If you were resilient positive to start with, then you experience the adversity, and the adversity is in all of its glorious pain and in all of its glorious fallout. Post the adversity, between 6 and 12 months, you are more likely to experience what we call post-traumatic growth. It is not the adversity, it is the assets that you have built as a human in order to be able to respond, value, self-respect as to what the hurt is, what the harm is, and know that you have that toolbox that you can go back into, that you are then able to say, now that I've settled, now that that is over, it doesn't mean that I hurt less, it means that the resilience allows me to suffer less. And so our notion of resilience is about what we do every single day. Not because of the adversity, but because as humans, we value and we create our resources by what we do every day. That adds to our level of well-being. Now, what's interesting about resilience is that we used to think And, you know, I was having a discussion before, that we used to think that resilience has a bounce back feature. Neuroscience tells us that's not quite true. And what we know about a resilient brain, or any brain for that matter, is that with every adversity that we experience, with every adversity, every challenge we have in our lives, every small difficulty or large difficulty that we have in our lives, that our brain learns from that. And if your learning is authentic and you tune in to what the information was, what happened, what didn't I do, what could I do next, is a resilient type of thought. So that it sets you up better for next time. But here's what neuroscience says. Neuroscience says it is not possible to bounce back from an adversity. It's simply not possible. Because if I experience an adversity and I bounce back to where I was, then I've done no learning. But resilience is not about bouncing back, it's about bouncing forward. And bouncing forward means I experience the adversity, I understand the challenge, I unpack it, I have a level of appraisal that I can appreciate what has occurred, and then I can say, what have I learned? And then take that with me as I step forward. Because our definition, our neuroscience definition of resilience is advancing despite adversity. That when we are talking about how do we optimize ourselves, it is about a forward moving direction, regardless of where we're at and what we're doing. And advancing despite adversity is this notion that when I build my level of capacity and I'm really clear about what my goals are in life, whether they are here, immediate, whether they are medium, whether they are long term, it's actually irrelevant. And the point is, you can change your goals at any time. It is well within your jurisdiction to make decisions about where you're at and what direction you're going. But what's important is that you have a direction. Because when adversity hits, you become flooded, disorientated, confused. And if I'm not clear about where my direction is, I will not move forward, I will be moving back. And so part of understanding advancing despite adversity is that the advancing is so crucial. And the advancing is how we do that in a way that is hopeful, not hopeless. And that we move forward in a way that allows us to advance. The advancing and the moving despite the adversity big or small, but the despite is the interesting part, because the despite is about prevention. Regardless of what's happening, I've got the tools to keep moving forward. And so part of what we do at Salutogenics is that we've become preventative practitioners. Because after so many years in my clinic, and I keep getting the same thing come through over and over and over and over and over and over, it is exactly the same. What is getting worse is that the symptomology is intensifying. What we used to be able to treat, high prevalence disorders like anxiety and depression, are no longer treatable. There is a treatment-resistant pattern that we are seeing. And there are a number of reasons for that. That's another workshop. But when we are talking about our work is in the preventative practices space. We now realise that there is poorer recovery rates if we wait for people to burn out. And so what we do is that we teach programs around resilience. We teach people what it is, what it isn't, what it looks like, and what do we need to do in order to build those assets. Now, I don't know whether I'm close to 20 minutes, so I'm going to leave it there. That gives you a little bit of... Are there any questions? Yes,